I'm here with Sam Taylor-Wood. Sam's artistic practice, which engages with extreme emotions, often enacted within the trope of the isolated film frame, disturbs and intrigues us with the lust to know more. Your work, Sustaining the Crisis and Hysteria, continues your dialogue with film, using actors and friends as central characters. Can we talk a little bit about this work?
Well, Sustaining the Crisis was shot just before Christmas 97. One half of it was made in King's Cross, where I filmed a friend of mine, Amanda, who I've used in a lot of my work. I had her walking topless through York Way, which is a very long street running through King's Cross. And the idea was to have this image projected on one wall of a woman sort of striding quite sort of nonchalantly and staring beyond the camera. When you're looking at it, I'm hoping that you look at it and can't quite sort of figure out why she's walking without her top on, as, you know, whether it's she's suffered some kind of trauma or whether she's in a sort of drug state mind or whether she's just forgotten. Because she's so sort of preoccupied in her thoughts. So she's sort of striding towards you, and it's slightly in slow motion. And then on the opposite wall is another projection. And that projection is of a man who's an actor who I didn't know before. And I just asked him for the 10-minute duration of the film to hold the look of shock so that after a while, after two or three minutes, his face might sort of drop or change expression. But the whole piece looks very acted, and he is sort of trying to sustain this look of shock. And then his gaze is directed at the woman walking down the street in the film, which is projected opposite. So you, even when you're standing in the space, you can't see both projections at the same time, but you immediately make a relation between the two. You immediately relate the fact that he's looking shocked and she's sort of doing something which could be quite sort of shocking to see. And so that's almost like you start to begin to invent a narrative in your mind for what you're seeing.
You often engage with very extreme emotions in your work, particularly I'm thinking of Hysteria and Cry Laughing. Do you want to talk a little bit about why that happens, do you think?
Well, firstly, again, with Cry Laughing, that's a sort of series of still photographs, quick shots of somebody looking like they could be crying or they could be laughing, and it's difficult to determine which. It sort of made me think that it would work as a film more than as the photographs. And what I wanted to do was really just to take what are seemingly two extreme emotions at opposite ends and to sort of bring them together so that they're not too dissimilar, that they are both sort of almost one act of hysteria. And use this actress, who's a very good actress, also a friend of mine. About 2 years ago, I met her and she'd suffered sort of quite a sad tragedy in her family. The first time I met her, and we were on holiday, and for the whole of the 2 weeks we were on holiday, she was laughing and laughing hysterically, like all the time. And you know, her sister had died just a couple of weeks before. And then, you know, 2 years later, I'm thinking about making this piece, you know, probably inspired by that time, but sort of locked in the back of my mind that Katrina could do it perfectly and would do it sort of so brilliantly. So we spent the morning filming that, and it was quite an intense, it was a very intense morning, you know, having someone sort of laugh and cry hysterically in front of you. And then I decided just to sort of put it slightly into slow motion and to take away the sound so that there was, again, sort of less to determine the act. So that you were kind of caught between, oh, you know, she's really laughing, she's really happy, no, she's really crying, she's really unhappy. So. And again, sort of those two extreme emotions just coming together to make one overall feeling.
I'm thinking of one of the first film pieces you did, Method in Madness. Mm.
That piece, I think, was the first film piece that I made. And it was shot on 16mm, firstly because I wanted it to speak the same language as cinematic film and not to shoot it on video so that it had a completely different quality. But that piece, again, is kind of similar to how Hysteria works. I wanted to use somebody who was who worked within the sort of Method School of acting, and to say to that person, to almost test the extreme of their vocation. So to say to a Method actor, you know, I want to make a film of you for 10 minutes, which is unedited, of you having a nervous breakdown. That was the first time I'd worked with someone on such an intense piece, and so I didn't really know what to expect, and I was sort of very naive with my 16mm camera. Okay, go. And suddenly this man in front of me completely collapses, crumbles, and hits himself about the head, screams and cries, but at which point I'm completely traumatised, thinking, what have I done? and then sort of titling the piece, Method in Madness, and the other part of the idea was that here is somebody who's acting, they're doing their job, and when you're watching it, it's, again, it's so sort of well acted, but because it's method acting, it's calling from sort of true emotions inside. So there's this sort of double play going on as to whether it's sort of real and authentic as an emotion or not.
I'd like to also talk about another piece which is quite extraordinary, and that's Brontosaurus.
It was made specifically on Hi8 Video, but I wanted it just to have a sort of quite home movie quality about it, that somebody just set up the camera and filmed themselves dancing naked in the bedroom, as we all do, or I do anyway. Initially I set out because people said, were looking at my work saying, God, it's really sort of quite heavy emotions and quite sort of manic, and I thought, well, okay, I'm going to set out here to make quite an uplifting piece of work. So I said to this friend of mine, John, who's in a lot of my work, mainly because he's one of those people that will do anything, and he's had no qualms about dancing in front of me naked, and I said to him I wanted him to dance to quite fast music, so it's kind of jungle, very fast beat music, and so we were both sort of falling about laughing, crying with laughter at what was going on, and as I was filming it, the camera was sort of moving because I was laughing so much, and it was sort of seemed to be quite a fun thing. Anyway, when I got back, I sort of edited it down to about sort of 20 minutes of material to use, and then I was looking at it and I put it into slow motion, just sort of playing around. And as it went into slow motion, his movements became, from being sort of very frenetic, they became sort of very odd, but still quite beautiful. The way that he was moving was sort of graceful within the sort of oddity of what he was doing as well. Then I thought, well, I took away the jungle music, and I found this piece of music. It was used in Apocalypse Now. And as I was watching it, it just fitted perfectly with what was what I was trying to achieve with the piece, which I wasn't kind of clear about as I was going along. And when it all came together, it just suddenly was perfect. And I looked at it, and I was a bit uneasy with the piece. I couldn't work out what it was, and so I showed it to a friend of mine who came in and just said, that's the most depressing piece of work you've ever made. It's really sad and upsetting. Whilst looking at it, I kind of sort of looked at it more and more and sort of felt much more what I was trying to get at a bit with it. And the music sort of made it, and the slow motion and the sort of nakedness suddenly gave it a quality of like a eulogy. It looked like it was, this, when you see these wonderful documentaries like Nureyev one, everything goes into slow motion, classical music over, and it's like a sort of dance of life and death. And so it sort of gave this idea of some, extinction and just the sort of frailty of life and that energy, and with the music as well, sort of giving it this sort of death feel as well.
What do you think attracts you to this kind of performance in your work and these so strong emotions that are very disturbing, but because they're slightly off key?
What interests me in making the work I'm making is when you are in the cinema and you're having sort of emotions sort of mediated to you, they're always set within a sort of narrative structure. So as you're watching somebody having a crisis, you know why, you know where it's come from, and you know then what happens, and you can sort of in some way you associate yourself with it and maybe that situation a little bit. What I was more interested in was sort of taking that instance, which is sort of 20 seconds maybe edited into a film, and to just sort of draw it out for its sort of almost natural length of process. And then just to look that much more closely at it, and just to sort of feel that you are watching a performance as well. You're watching a performance by somebody who's been asked to do this for a camera. And you're aware of that, but at the same time you're witnessing a very strong emotion that you can sort of relate to.
you do tend to do very much in a Warholian way, use characters you know, characters that you've gathered around you and worked with repeatedly. Can you talk a little bit about that as a working method?
I tend to work with people I know much more, because then you know what their possibilities and capabilities are. You know, I work with Amanda Ooms quite a lot. I first met her through an old friend of mine, Joshua Compston. With Pent Up, I used her in Sustaining the Crisis. I've worked with her. But anyway, the other thing about her, I mean, she's a good actress. I know that she's good. I know what she can and can't do. And whenever I'm sort of working out an idea, she tends to sort of fit in. I work with her, and I work with her on a very close level. It is quite a collaboration. I sit down with her and we talk a lot about the idea, and she really wants to know exactly what the idea is and where it's coming from and where it's going to go. And so in that respect, we work sort of very closely. And then, you know, she knows the kind of performance I want, and she sort of tends to kind of give it very quickly. With, for instance, when I was working on the piece Sustaining the Crisis with the guy I'd never met before, I sort of felt a little uncomfortable asking him to react so strongly and to go through this strong emotion, but I have to just reassure myself it's his job. But working with friends also, I sort of, in all the five revolutionary seconds, most of them are friends. The only time that I haven't worked with friends was when I needed two people, or I wanted to have two people having sex in a chair. And so I worked with a sort of porn couple who actually go out together, and so they didn't mind doing that for a fiver. But it's kind of, when I meet people and know people, it's like having a sort of Rolodex in my mind, and I have an idea and I sort of think of the kind of person that I want to work with, and you know, I sort of tend to find that a lot of my friends around me are sort of inspirational.
Your collaboration with the Pet Shop Boys, again, a slight digression for you, but using your very characteristic methods.
Yeah, that was a fun, brilliant thing to do. It was a good diversion at a time when I needed to be diverted. It came from Neil Tennant from the Pet Shop Boys, saw the piece Pent Up, and got in touch with me and said that they were thinking of doing this concert, and they wanted to do it in a theatre, and they wanted to work with an artist. They'd worked with Derek Jarman before. And so I decided to make a piece which would be two screens sort of flanking either side of the stage, in which a party would be taking place, which starts off, which would be in real time for the whole hour and a half concert. But there's two halves, so it would start off in black and white with everyone pretty sober at a party, almost the beginning of a party, and then at the beginning of the second half it goes up into colour, sort of a bit Wizard of Oz like, and everyone's completely plastered, drunk, drugged, whatever, and that Neil and Chris would interact with that party, so they would be in the party in the film, and then they would come out onto stage, sing however many songs, and then go back into the party and enjoy themselves. Well, it sounded sort of straightforward when I had the idea, but then it was a nightmare to film, because it was filmed 2 weeks before the concert, and had to be timed to the millisecond, because when they're singing, to suddenly sort of walk into another room, they had to make it work, they had to really get their footsteps timed, they had to open the door off stage and then be on into the party. And people thought that the party was going on backstage and that's how it worked. But no, it was far more clever.
Your references in your work, you've often stated, are filmic.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of my influences, I've sort of openly say, are Warhol's films. I mean, more than his paintings, but I think his films are absolutely phenomenal, where he was a total genius, really. At a time when there was a lot of underground film being made, but that sort of filming in real time, using people as personalities, like we were saying before, was just amazing. And, you know, Empire, I think, is one of the greatest films ever made. Not that I've seen it. But I mean, with Warhol, he was, you know, used, I doubt he was first, but I'm sure he was, you know, the most well-known for doing, was using sort of real time and unedited time. So really just letting things unfold in front of them, giving a sort of brief, which people then sort of respond to in whatever way. That's definitely kind of how I'm working, but at the same time working in a very different way, because he was just filming you know, people sort of having a party, or, you know, just letting things unfold in in the natural way. With me, I'm a bit stricter, I suppose. I need a sort of particular performance from somebody. And then again, I suppose Cassavetes is another sort of big influence. Woman Under the Influence, I think, is one of the sort of greatest films I've ever seen. People sort of seem to think that I'm sort of setting out to be autobiographical. I don't think that my work's autobiographical intentionally, but obviously there are, because it's made by me, some of it comes from me.
In your early work, you used yourself. Mm. You don't use yourself now. Why is that?
When I was working with myself in the portraits earlier, it was because I was sort of making work with very... It was to do with having limited means, and you kind of think about an idea, and and I wasn't brave enough either to be able to go to someone and say, I want you to do this for me. I was sort of much more, you know, for instance, the piece I made, Slut, it's very difficult to say to somebody, would you mind asking someone to give you sort of 20 love bites and calling yourself a slut for me? Whereas that was sort of quite specifically a self-portrait, and I wanted to do that piece myself because I didn't feel comfortable with the idea of sort of putting someone else in that position. Whereas with the sort of work that I'm making now, it's not pointing at somebody and sort of saying something like, you know, the slut piece was. This is much more sort of general, broad and open. And I have to be behind the camera to see if I'm getting the right performance.
Tell me about Pent Up.
It's five film projections, and all shot on 16mm film, all shot at different times, because there's a woman walking down the street, there's a man sitting up late at night in his house, there's another man walking around his sort of bedroom, bathroom, getting dressed to go out in the afternoon, and a woman drunk in a bar at 4 in the morning, and another man sort of raging in his garden in the middle of the day. So they were all filmed at very different times, but it was scripted very tightly so that whatever they say is then answered by someone in the other film. So you're seeing all five projections simultaneously. And so the idea of the piece really is that there are these five people in different states of isolation and in sort of different scenarios where if you saw them, for instance, the woman walking down the street, you would sort of immediately assume she was mad, schizophrenic, drugs, whatever. And again, with the woman in the bar, you'd think she was drunk and sort of talking to herself. And so each person is sort of, if you saw the films individually, would be speaking to themselves. But what happens is it becomes this dialogue. So in turn, they answer each other. But then the conversation doesn't really go anywhere. It's not a conversation. It's just these sort of spontaneous replies. And so you don't get a sense of narrative. And again, you almost edit it yourself by which person you choose to look at, and you start to sort of build relationships between the people.
We were talking about not using yourself physically in the work, but there are aspects that are autobiographical.
I know that there's a piece that I'd already planned to make before sort of last year, because it was I went to Washington for this show that I've got there, and I had a look at this space, and I sort of had this idea that I wanted to make a film of a woman sort of lying and filmed using sort of five, maybe six cameras, and then have them projected separately but slow and speed some of the timing on the projectors so that the parts of the body move out of time with the other parts of the body, but it's one whole long body. But I know now that people are going to think that this piece is totally autobiographical to do with the fact that I was ill and you know, I had to have a major operation over Christmas, and that this was all to do with the fact of, you know, having sort of feeling dissected. And you know, for me it didn't come from that, but the terrifying thing is if I'm a witch and I can foresee it.
I'm here with Dorothy Cross in her studio in Dublin. Dorothy, I'd like to begin by discussing Ghost Ship, your most recent commission, which is wonderfully presenting itself in Dublin Bay at the moment.
I suppose in some ways the Ghost Ship is probably a big change in my work. It's a terribly simple idea. It doesn't need to be discussed in any great depth to grasp significance or meaning. I borrowed a lightship, and for this project called the Nissan Project. It's held every year, and you're invited to put in a proposal to make a piece of work that only exists for a short time. So it's a fantastic laboratory, like an extension of your own studio. and you're funded to do something that normally you probably couldn't afford to do. I had this idea to use a light ship because I was brought up in the south of Ireland near this particular ship called the Daunt, and this particular one I borrowed is called the Albatross and was built in Glasgow in 1928. And it's a beautiful steel-hulled ship that had no engine, and they were moored to the bottom of the sea, and men lived on them for months on end, and they had lighthouses built on them, or light decks, to warn other ships passing by of the hidden danger. So when we were kids, we were brought out to this particular ship called the Daunt, and it was very much a kind of odyssey for us, and there was romance around it, and my father was a man who always wanted to go to sea and never had, and instilled all of us kids in his passion for the sea, I think because of his separation from it. And this particular ship called the Albatross had been moored for many years against a dock in Dublin. And I had been watching it thinking I'd love to do something with that. It was like a big metal sculpture. I said to someone the other day it was like kind of a Richard Serra with history and heart. And it's this hulk that is very impotent and has to be tugged to be moved. So you're looking at a functioning ship that is kind of in some ways functionless and disempowered. So the idea for the project was to give it another phase in its life and talk about its obliteration in some sense, because the ships have been decommissioned. In the 70s, the majority of these ships around Ireland have been replaced with satellite buoys, which are these kind of small, insignificant physical things. So I started researching luminosity and thinking it would be beautiful to create the notion of a ghost using the actual ship. But also it would be It would be ephemeral, it would be obvious that it's still the ship there, and you would be looking at some trickery of light. So I wanted to make it with, not just with theatre lighting, where we could have used fluorescence with dimmers. So we researched luminosity, which is a phosphorus-based paint, which absorbs light and emanates on its own. So in fact, the ship is creating its own glow. And it took a long time, and it was terribly expensive to find the right type of paint. But what we've now done is painted this 140-foot long albatross ship with a very thin skin of luminous paint, built a UV light rig off the hull and up towards the superstructure. And there's this cycle of light. Every 20 minutes, the ship is illuminated for 8 minutes, the lights go off, and then it glows on its own. From a kid to a granny, we all have the notion of the ghost ship. You know, there are many Irish fairy tales that refer to it. But also, it's about the light being discontinuous. It's about something that repeats itself. So as a viewer, you have a chance to see it again and again. So the ghost ship, for me, is incredibly public, and it's incredibly appealing. And I don't have a record of being appealing. And yet, all my work all along the road of my life has appealed to me and excited me from the first germ of the idea. Because I'm interested in the disquietness of a lot of the work and kind of getting under my own skin primarily, and it's not an intentional attempt to be controversial, but what shakes me and makes me disturbed and there equally makes me curious. And if that happens in the process of making a piece of work, that is the energy that excites me to push the thing further, and therefore I want to transmit that to the viewer and make them feel uncomfortable, because I think the whole role of art anyway is about breaking down kind of almost like the plasterwork of what is considered normal, and through those fissures looking at other viewpoints. And that is very unnerving for people, because every day with modern life we're more and more sealed up by the plasterwork.
So I'm thinking of one of your early works, The Holy Bible.
With something like The Holy Bible, I was brought up in a family, you know, that, and what my father was the history. My father, in some ways, was the ship, and my mother was the Japanese plate. So there was aesthetic and there was history, and there was incredible support, but there was not controversy. There was not political extremes. My father was brought up in the Civil War in Ireland. My mother was brought up in London during the war. So to begin with, that was very opposite, but that thing of using objects, the Bible, for example, belonged to my family, but my family was not a very Bible family. We weren't extremely religious at all. My father died when I was 22, and even before he was dying, he would come into my room and say, "I'm throwing this piece of old ship's stuff away," you know, knowing I would say, "No, you're not, I want it." But Subsequently, my mother had all these objects, things like the Bible, the dish covers that had the udders under them, all that kind of middle-class bourgeois stuff that I was in line to inherit. But I didn't want to just continue that inheritance on in a regular way and pass it on again. I was very interested in obliterating it or transforming it. I had gone through a process in the late 80s where I was working very much under the shroud of psychoanalysis, and I was approaching work very much in a kind of constructive way. This means that this, therefore that means that, this goes with this, and I would go to the shrink and it would be Dorothy Work Shrink. And it would be this triangle of significance and meaning. But I consciously stopped doing that at a point because I felt I was trying to write the script of the work before the work existed. So in the early 90s, when I was working for the Arnold Feeney show, Even, the Bible and the snakes started infiltrating my studio down in County Wicklow, which was actually a very beautiful place situated in this garden. And I would go down there every day, and it was quite removed from the city. And the Bible sat there, and I was going, what am I going to do with this Bible? And then one day I just thought, I'll drill a hole in it. And that's the way I'm working much more now. And it's actually about faith, in some ways, in the unconscious, which is probably more scary, but possibly more freeing than intellectually approaching the unconscious. So I drilled the hole with fear and trepidation that I would rip the pages. It was in no way about tearing the words. It was about the physical book. And I rang up, you know, bookbinders, laser cutters to see who could make the hole perfect. And they all said, no, we can't make the hole perfect. We'll either burn it with the laser or we'll rip the pages. And anyway, why are you drilling a hole in the Bible? So eventually I did make the hole perfect. And the pleasure of that, of the beauty of the smoothness of the hole, physically on one hand was one thing. But the other thing was that the Bible for me stood as an object that was negative. Being brought up Catholic in Ireland and living through the transformation that has occurred in the church here in recent days and the decimation, when I was younger, there was an immense amount of anger around it, and then I just dismissed it, and then I looked at Beckett and took on Beckett as my new religion, which was, he was so fabulously chaotic and you know, fragmented, and he became a kind of a lifeboat in some ways. But so in drilling a hole in that Bible, I was so happy, and I did say to someone who was upset about it one time that it was like, for me, a new icon. It was that before the Bible had been something negative, but now that it was something totally positive. And again, to elaborate slightly on it, I'm very interested in the removal of the physical through Christianity, or certainly Catholicism, where the body is bad. And the point where I had drilled the hole through the middle, I wasn't sure where that would fall in the images throughout the Bible. But what happened was, I opened the book at one point, and I use a lot of my intellectual and academic friends to confirm the significance of my ideas these days, and I rely on them enormously, and I love them for their input. But I opened the book at where the two Marys were standing at the tomb, and the hole had fallen right where their hearts are. And I said to my friend, I want to show it here, but I don't know why I've done this. And he said, but of course, Dorothy, you should know why you've done this. This is a point where Jesus dies. They come to the tomb and he's disappeared. So the body that they have loved with their heart and soul is gone. So they are devastated. And the hole is where their hearts are. But by the removal of that body, because that's the point in Christianity, where Jesus goes up, is subsumed into heaven, and the body is no longer important. The word becomes flesh. And the word is what's significant from that point on. And as a, you know, even without knowing the significance of that, I felt always in my body that there was something wrong. So what, by making the whole about the absence, the loss, you know, for the women, the Marys who loved him, also you're sexualizing it in a way because it's like some beautiful, smooth kind of glory hole. I'm trying to, what I did without knowing really was reinvested with the physicality.
I remember very vividly you saying, I felt for me the Bible was somehow incomplete. By drilling the hole in it, I made it complete.
That's
for
right.
me.
Which is contradictory in some ways, but yes, exactly.
Yes, but in a way you were completing a kind of the whole cycle of this disappearance, and as you say.
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk a little bit about the work with the udders? And I know that you've said before that, you know, you don't want to be known as the udder woman, but they did feature for a while really very prolifically in your work.
Mm.
How did that first come about? I mean, was it you know, how did the idea of using the udders first come about?
Well,
really,
again, the idea was very luck and simple. I was up in Norway doing a public project for a sculpture trail, I suppose you could call it, called Arsket Nordland. And Maretta Jaukari from Finland had invited me to make a piece of work. And so I was up researching the neighbourhood, this lovely little community. And the people had brought me out up fjords, up mountains, eating cloudberries and everything. And they brought me to this fabulous little museum. There was like a folk museum. And on the wall was a sieve made out of a cow's udder. And the Norwegians are very economical, used every part of the cow. And they're like that. And but I was drawn to it. Bam! It was like a little Irish baron drum with little handmade holes with these four little bald teeth and even a little patch. Very, very beautiful. And it, of course, it was, you know, it was Merritt Oppenheim multiplied, because when you get that thrill of art in real life, it's 10 million times better than it is in an art gallery, I always find. So I came back then to Ireland and worked with a taxidermist and got the cow's skin the wrong way around. So normally the udder's thrown away. And so it was 2 or 3 years of just, it was actually almost, I almost had to do nothing. I would walk into the studio and the teat would say, okay, today you're going to be stuck on a rugby ball. And I probably made 22, 23 pieces with udders. And the prime ones being, I suppose, Virgin Shroud, which is in the Tate now, where the teeth are on the head, which is very much tied in with mothering the intellect over in compensation of the breast. And then the piece like Amazon, which is the single-teated tailor's dummy, where the overlap between penis and teat becomes incredibly clear. And, I could talk about these for hours and hours and hours, but that is the central point of the other works, is that where the teat especially is seen in a singular way, you have an absolute duality of penis, breast, so nurturing nipple, phallus. And it's not an obliteration of the breast either, because when you see the teat on its own, it's still a milk-giving thing. And also I've spoken about the fact that Freud, I had read Dora's case studies years before, and he says, of course, when we look at the udder of a cow, in that wonderful sweeping way that Freud always did, we think of the penis. So what they did, though, I think those ones in particular, all the other works, was came into regular life, whether it's a rugby ball, whether it's a dish cover, whether it's a tailor's dummy. All the works were around things that were terribly familiar. So there was a comfort in that in some sense for the viewer. But then the discomfort of the isolated teat was incredibly unsettling for a lot of people. And even for me, when I was working on the first, I hid them in my studio. I remember when people came in, because I thought, God, what am I? It was that cross between being a butcher or a, you know, plastic surgeon. That it was some kind of, and also they were wet and moist when I had to cut them and stuff them, and they smelt of cheese. And I was very conscious of the life of the cow. But also I was very conscious that the cow was getting another kind of reincarnation. And that kind of reincarnation thing, I think, is interesting, because there's a loss around the cow too. And the loss is a word that is never used really in relationship to my work, but it's all about that. You know, I remember Helen Chadwick actually saying that once, we used to be in shows a lot together, and I totally loved her work and her, and she said, Dorothy, all your work is about anxiety and all mine is about celebration. And I think she was totally right.
This multiplicity of media you work in, which obviously you're selecting it appropriately for what you're dealing with. So you work with photography, installation, sculpture, and video. And I'd just like to talk about your video piece, Storm in a Teacup.
Mm-hmm. Well, Storm in a Teacup, it was the first video thing I ever did, and it was an invitation for a few artists to work with multimedia. It's the simplest thing to do on Photoshop on computer. What you see is a 10-inch monitor, and in the monitor is sitting a very beautiful, polite teacup that belonged to my mother also. She lent it to me for the thing. And it's porcelain, it's afternoon tea, it's all that. It's quite... And that is also associated with the colonizer, you know, perfect politeness at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And inset into this, and actually this is probably irrelevant for a lot of people, but it's a big part of my concern, because the piece was endearing for people, but there was an underbelly to it that attracted me. Within the cup is a 3-minute loop of a film, and the film is a very famous film in Ireland called Man of Arran. And it was a film made by Robert Flaherty in the 30s. On the Aran Islands and the west coast of Ireland, which were are still physically, geologically, one of the most beautiful places in the world. They're limestone, karst area, like a desert of limestone. And it was very hard to live there. And fishermen lived there dragging seaweed onto fields and creating earth and going out in tiny curraghs to fish, which were these wooden skeleton boats covered in tar and canvas. And there's a famous sequence in the film of this curragh bobbing around in a storm. So we vignetted 3 minutes of that in the teacup. So what you have is this tiny little boat with these men rowing. It's like a little beetle, and it crashes on the rocks. So that life is disappearing in Ireland now, and I have a terrible sadness about the disappearance of that. But also in its containment within the cup, you have this kind of contrary life. So there's a conflict between the cup and the life on the Aran Islands, which, you know, could be talked about in many different ways. But also, it's about a domestic ocean. You know, you could talk about it back to the Merritt Oppenheim teacup, lots of things. But it is a taming. I love the notion of risk and the notion of wildness. And the life of those people in the curraghs was extreme. And even the life of the men in the ghost ship, you know, they were out there without any engine, tied to a reef in the bottom of the ocean by a chain. When that chain broke, they were scuppered. And many people lost their lives. But what I love about even these kind of discussions is, you know, you can connect everything. And that's where the psychoanalysis comes in, I suppose, in some ways, because that's what's wonderful about Carl Jung in terms of interpretation, which is different from Freud, is that multiplicity of connection or whatever. But the one thing I was thinking there a minute ago is there's been a shift. I think with the cows, there was still this real need to kind of look possibly at the kind of underbelly of things. And I don't know what piece actually changed that. It might have been when I was asked to work in this train project in Belgium, actually, that Helen was in as well, where I'd made a kiss. And it was a very conscious effort to make a piece about love. But in the end of the day, it ended up being a piece about holes and loss. So I thought of trains, I thought of love, I thought of black and white movies where men meet women and kiss and then they never see them again, the ultimate in romance. So I thought about kisses. How do you manifest a kiss? So then I went through the process of getting alginate dental plaster, putting it in people's mouths, kissing them, and trying to get this skeletal form from the inside of the two mouths. It was hilarious, it was not sexual, and it was very difficult to do, because what you ended up with was this very fragile, wobbly, rubbery thing that came out. And when you were extricating yourself from the person's mouth, it ripped usually. So I probably had 60 and ended up with 3. And then we cast it in silver, but it was so, so delicate. And what you get looks like a bone. So that's another thing that's so fabulous in the whole process of the making, is that the things surprise you in the end. But where the point of passion is most intense in that cast of the kiss, which looks like two dentures glued together, is the hole, because the hole is where the lips push most closely together. And that point of intimacy is impossible to hold. So it's like the skeleton of a kiss. It's like the loss of the kiss, but at the same time, it's the kiss.
Dorothy, you're working on a new project at the moment. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's. I'm totally excited about it at the moment. It's going to be in a handball alley in the west of Ireland, and there are these handball alleys that are concrete structures that are like big formula Sol Lewitz or Don Judd's, and handball is the third official sport in Ireland after Gaelic football and hurling, and it was very, very popular in the 40s and 50s, incredibly popular, and there are like 400 cast concrete alleys around Ireland that are hardly ever used anymore, and a lot of them are being knocked down. And I was invited by the Project Art Centre in Dublin to do an off-site project, and Fiach McAneil, the director, said, have you any ideas, Dorothy? I said, actually, I do. I love these handball alleys. Can I do something in the handball alley? And about 5 years ago, I worked on an opera with a company here called Opera Theatre Company, where I designed and did costumes for a production of Handel's Tamerlano. Working with those people, on one hand, instilled me with a much more passion for opera, and at the same time made me look at kind of the role of the voice in the space. And you'd hear them singing phrases, their most difficult phrases, over and over again. So you'd go from Tamerlano to Bajazet to whatever, and you'd hear these phrases without any orchestration, lingering, kind of hauntingly in these corridors. The project is called Chiasm, C-H-I-A-S-M. And it is a physiological term about the point where two lines intersect. So, and by association, what is on either side of those lines mirrors itself. So what I'm using these alleys in County Galway in the west of Ireland, where two alleys are built onto two. And there's a pool in the back of the Aran Islands, which are these famous islands on the west coast of Ireland, that's called Powell na Beisht, which means the worm's hole. I can show you photographs in a minute. And this is a rectangular pool that is naturally formed by a subsidence of limestone, and it's like the size of a swimming pool. It looks like it's been cut by an engineer. And the sea comes in subterraneally and surges up and down, and it's the most beautiful, I think it's a wonder of the world. It's spectacularly, extraordinarily beautiful. So we've been going out there with Cian de Butler, a filmmaker here, filming the pool from eight different angles, because the geometry and proportions of it are very similar to the geometry and proportions of the handball alley. Then we're going to have two 90-foot towers projecting the film into the floors of the handball alleys, so that you'll have this attempt to fit the illusion of the ocean within a rectangle within a rectangle. So what will happen is that if you're viewing it, there'll be a big lighting or a seating rig behind the alleys that you'll have to view from above. Then every 20 minutes, a soprano will come into one alley and a tenor will come into the other within the film. And the soprano will come in and she will sing fragments of all these operas, going from extreme love to extreme loss. And at the same time, the tenor will be in the other alley singing fragments. So I've actually worked out a kind of sculptural structure, because it'll be very discomforting for most people, because there'll be no orchestration. There'll be no seductive network holding the notes. And the singers will sound shattered. And it will actually be very difficult for a lot of people to listen to it, I think. But I wanted to sound as if they've lost their memories, so that the narrative is broken down. And like the pool that they're standing in, like the wave returning again and again, every wave is slightly different, but it's about the repetition. And all these narrative operas are attempting to talk about love, passion and loss. And it's this human need to present this. And this will be a 20-minute cycle.